this episode of Fat Girl Book Club. For this episode, we read the book Fearing the Black Body by Sabrina Strings. I don't really have a lot of housekeeping items to tell you about at the beginning of this episode because I'm actually heading into a break. I haven't had a break in a really long time. There will still be episodes of the podcast and there will be new episodes of the podcast, so no worries there. But when it comes to posting online and the book club right now that's going on in Facebook and all the newsletters, that's all going to be a little bit of a hiatus. Yay! So I'm going to be taking the month of August to kind of rethink the way the book club is going. And if you are at all interested in how that shapes up, if you like to read these types of books and you'd love to get in on a book club, maybe in September. As they say, September is all about setting goals, just like the new year is. So if that is of any interest to you, then make sure that you jump into the Facebook group that I've got going, because I am doing polls and the book for September will be picked and there's all sorts of good stuff going on in there. But I'm not going to be really posting too much social media stuff besides stuff about the episodes I have coming out. And I really won't be sending out any of those weekly newsletters that people have been seeing. So the only newsletter you will see is the August newsletter, the monthly newsletter. So that's kind of going to allow me a little bit of space. If this is your first episode here, welcome. If the information here sounds of interest to you, if you kind of want to know a little bit more about how to change your body image, how to start looking at yourself in the mirror and being comfortable with what you're seeing, I have a resource for you. It's a free resource. It's called the Your Better Body Image Checklist, and you can grab it on my website. It gives you a few really practical things that you can do to begin to change your body image. And it is a checklist. You can actually check things off, which I don't know about you, but for me, that's really satisfying. All right, let me tell you a little bit about the book that we read for this episode. So I guess I should let you know that this is the second time this book has been featured on this podcast. I think there's a reason why. This is a book that resonates with a lot of people because I think there was always talk, but I think there's been even more talk about how fat phobia and racism intersect and why fat phobia is racist. And there's lots of people who don't quite understand this. And this book, Fearing the Black Body, really honestly begins to pull apart the roots of fat phobia and the progression of fat phobia as kind of an individual concept and how it begins to intersect with racism and how we are now in the current situation we are in, where they are very, very connected. So I think that's why this book has resonated so much and why we are featuring it again. So let me tell you a little bit about that book, just in case you haven't heard anything, although you probably have. I am reading the description off of Amazon for Fearing the Black Body. There is an obesity epidemic in this country, and poor black women are particularly stigmatized, diseased, and a burden on the public health care system. This is only the most recent incarnation of the fear of fat black women, which Sabrina Strings shows took root more than 200 years ago. Strings weaves together an eye-opening historical narrative ranging from the Renaissance to the current moment, analyzing important works of art, newspaper and magazine articles, and scientific literature and medical journals where fat bodies were once praised, showing that fat phobia, as it relates to black women, did not originate with medical findings, but with the Enlightenment-era belief that fatness was evidence of savagery and racial inferiority. The author argues that the contemporary ideal of slenderness is, at its very core, racialized and racist. Indeed, it was not until the early 20th century, when racialized attitudes against fatness were already entrenched in the culture, that the medical establishment began its crusade against obesity. An important and original work, Fearing the Black Body, argues convincingly that fat phobia isn't about health at all, but rather a means of using the body to validate race, class, and gender prejudice. I mean, really, when when I read that out, how can you not be impressed by the magnitude of this book? It is definitely, definitely important. My guest is one of the wonderful humans that I met on Clubhouse. Some of you have heard of this app. It's fairly new. It's a audio social media app where people can jump into rooms and have discussions around different topics. And it's all done by voice. So there's no picture component like there is with Instagram or Facebook. And I met Petrilli in one of the rooms that I was in, and she is just so thoughtful, and she has so many amazing things to say that I knew I had to invite her on, so I did. I also subscribed to her newsletter, and she's going to talk about her newsletter at the end of this episode. I highly recommend it. It is an interesting read that won't take a ton of your time. Let me tell you a little bit about Petrilli. Petrilli Hernandez, MS, she, they, has over 14 years of professional experience working in the health and nutrition sector as an educator, advocate, project manager, and policy analyst. She combines her academic background in culinary arts, anthropology, and nutrition/health with her lived experience as a large-bodied, neuroatypical, queer, multiracial femme of the Puerto Rican diaspora to disrupt the status quo of the local nutrition and wellness community and advocate for a weight-inclusive health paradigm in educational settings. Petrilli currently works with the DC early childhood community on nurturing and educating young children who are confident in their relationship with food, their health, and their bodies. In addition to being the founder of Embody Lib, a platform that helps people of the global majority reclaim their health and well-being. In her spare time, she likes cooking for others, looking at the moon, and spending time with her fiancé and her chihuahua. And with that, please enjoy this conversation with Petrilli Hernandez. Hi, Petrilli. Welcome to Fat Girl Book Club.
Oh my gosh. Thank you so much. I'm so thrilled to be here. Super excited.
We are going to be jumping into Fearing the Black Body by Sabrina Strings, and I'm just delighted that you're here to talk about this book. But let's start with a little bit about you. So can you tell the listeners a little bit about your body liberation journey?
Of course, of course. First, I'm also just as excited to discuss this book. This book has been a big part of my body liberation journey and kind of research and knowledge. So yes, my name is Petrilli. I go by the Body Lib Advocate on Instagram. My pronouns are she, her, and they, them. My body liberation journey is always ongoing and it's ever evolving. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, people talk about their life journeys and their process for growth and what I call unraveling, where there are points in your life where you are confronted with truths that challenge everything you thought you knew about the world. And so I've had those definitely throughout my life, but the ones that spark a lot of the work that I do now and my passion for body liberation started in about 2017 when I was diagnosed with an eating disorder in my early 30s. So a little bit of context around that. So I have been in the health and wellness and nutrition space in some form or another for almost 15 years and spent a lot of it. I went from culinary to nutrition education to getting a master's in the nutrition field. And, you know, really thinking that the work I was doing in the world was making it a better place, was, you know, making people healthier. And being diagnosed with an eating disorder was a big shock, I think, to me and the people around me. And so that really sparked what I call the great unraveling of 2018 and still continues, where I, you know, really started to question my passion and interest in nutrition and bodies and trying to erase fatness. That was, I think, just a projection, right, of how I felt about myself and how it intersected with what I was taught to believe growing up. So since then, I have really focused on a couple of things, right? Unlearning everything that I had been for lack of a better word, indoctrinated with when it comes to what makes a body valuable, right? So I identify, I live in a large body, right? I am multiracial, but I am what I call, what is called white adjacent. So I do have light skin privilege. And I am queer, right? I am from the Puerto Rican diaspora. I'm neuroatypical, right? In a couple of different ways. And so how all of those identities, right? How I was so committed for so long to running away from those identities as a way to, you know, be in closer proximity to whiteness for, I can't really think of any other way to say it. So that's been included, right? Confronting my internalized fat phobia, my disordered eating, my negative body image, right? What I think about what it means to be queer, to live with mental illness, to be in a body of color, all of those things. So it's been bananas. And you know, as soon as I think that, okay, I think I have a grasp on it, something else happens that like forces me to grow and to evolve even more. So, you know, this book has definitely been a big part of, you know, challenging a lot of the notions that I believed about health and about nutrition and about weight and about myself in some ways, right? So, that's a little bit about that.
I love the really technical bananas term. That was great.
Yes. It's all bananas. B-A-N-A-N-A-S.
Well, okay, so what I'm really interested in is, like you were saying, that you had to kind of come to grasp with this, with all of your different identities and recognizing mm-hmm. that this proximity to whiteness, mm-hmm. that's what you had kind of been doing and kind of disengaging with those other identities. And I imagine that's kind of a two-part process where you're having to do one kind of, I had another guest on who said she had to do anti-colonial work for herself to mm-hmm. kind of break away from that. And then on the other side, also embrace all those identities. So how does that Absolutely. Work as a two-part kind of process?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And that's a really interesting perspective because, you know, it's about really learning to be at peace with the way that you navigate the world, right? And everything that comes with it, right? There are layers of oppression to that. And there are layers of privilege, right? I think we are all multifaceted and complex beings and individuals living in a society that, you know, abides by social hierarchies. So as much as we want to say, oh, it's all this or all that, right? I always talk about the destruction of the binary, right? The binary was set up to, you know, as a means of control, right? As a means of making one group feel superior and one group feel lesser, right? But where is all the nuance in that? Is that we could have identities that both uphold oppression and experience oppression, right? And I think body liberation for me personally is really finding a way to navigate those two sides and even the nuances in between all of that, right? Especially I think when it comes to my racial identity and you know, that is being complex and really coming to terms with what that means. But at the same time, recognizing that the color of my skin has benefited me in so many ways that you know, there are lots of people that don't experience that. Yes, I think doing the inner work is just as important, right? Doing the inner work, unlearning, being able to reclaim what it means to be well in your body, but it also, it's a way to equip you, right? To kind of look at these external systems of oppression and being able to say, okay, like this is what I feel inside, but how am I going to do the work outside of myself to make sure that we all are like collectively liberated? So yes, I love the example you brought up with this kind of, it's a dichotomy in a way, but it's, I feel like it happens simultaneously, right? In some of the workshops that I do and just some of the education I do, right? I talk about this narrative of self, right? Like what you believe about yourself is both constructed at the same time, like by your own lived experiences, right? How you feel, but it's also simultaneously constructed by how other people perceive you. So really being aware of that, right, I think is kind of the double work you were kind of referring to.
Yeah, it feels like a very, like such a process that would be overwhelming at times and hard to do. And like you said, this simultaneous onslaught of things that are happening. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, I mean, to get into the book a little bit, because I think we're kind of heading there. I don't know, for me, when I read the book, I got to a point where it was like, okay, this is how we got to this current time. And she takes us on this journey,
absolutely,
this historical journey about why we're here. Mm-hmm. So how does she kind of make her argument about this shift for Black women over time?
Yes. So I think this does tie perfectly into kind of what we were just talking about, how, you know, because of the current structure we're in, right, that really values heteronormativity, white supremacy, and like all the patriarchal BS that comes with it, the structure is there where there's this binary, right? There's whiteness and then there's Blackness, right? And then one, which is the whiteness, is viewed throughout the book as, you know, the most pure, the state you want to attain, right? The one that has the highest moral value. And on the other side of this coin, you have Blackness, right? Which is associated, that was coined by, at the beginning of the book, white men to be kind of the lowest form of value, beauty, et cetera. But what we see in this journey throughout the book is that kind of everything in between, right? Whether it's your gender, it's your ethnicity, it's your nationality. What else we see? We see body size too, of like how it's shifted from one to the other, how all of these different identities kind of play into this binary of whiteness and like Blackness, and how throughout time, because of the way that white supremacy is structured, we see the evolution of all these groups kind of like teetering back and forth between whiteness and then to Blackness, depending on what the power structure looked like at the time, right? Like if they wanted to focus power in this little group of elite white men, right? And they had the ability to control all these people around them, then everybody was Black, right? But as soon as they started losing that power, you see there were these other groups that were kind of allowed in. We see this with the white women. We see this with the Anglo-Saxons versus the Celts, then the Eastern Europeans, then the Italians, then the Irish, then the Latinos, right? So yeah, I think that this book did a really great job kind of breaking down the different parts of history and how we see that kind of teeter-totter of like power through art, through food, right? Because like my favorite chapter is chapter 7, which talks about the onset of like breakfast cereals, which is one of my favorite things to talk about ever. It is one of the most fascinating things, how it's portrayed through media, right? And how it filters into modern medicine. I just think the book does such a great job outlining all of that.
Yes. There was so many different threads. And this is mm-hmm. probably my third time through. And every time I read it,
yes,
I pick up on something different that's coming through for me. That's just like, oh my gosh, mm-hmm. why didn't I see that the first time I read it? That's because she has so much nuance, yeah. like you said. Mm-hmm. She specifically talks about and uses the words Black women to white women were a counterpart before the 1700s, then a counterpoint, and then an antithesis. And I thought her development of this was very interesting. I don't know what were your kind of thoughts around the way she kind of develops that?
Yeah, I mean, so I think this is brought up earlier in the book. I can't remember if it's chapter 3, where they talk about the perception of Blackness within, like, across Southern Europe, right? Especially Italy, where, you know, in the first two chapters, it really talks about the creation of the beauty standard through the lens of white European men and what the definition of beauty is, right? And we talk about the different Venuses and, you know, the role that dark-skinned Venuses kind of played in this ideal beauty. And I just thought it was really interesting, right? Because when we talk about the beauty standard from that classical era, whatever that means. Yep. That's a colonial term, but I'm just going to use it for like the purposes of this book. When we talk about the definition of beauty from the classical era, right, we really see it from a heteronormative male point of view, right? And that starts to include all women. I think that really starts to shift with the onset of chattel slavery, right? And the propaganda and the messaging that people that were in the slave trade were relaying to the general public to justify the horrendous actions. And so that's why you see that shift kind of pre-1700s, right? Even pre-1650s during the Renaissance era, and then which is essentially capitalism, right? Chattel slavery is the foundation for American capitalism, and how they used basically money, right, as a way to control the narrative of womanhood and the status of women and who was viewed as more valuable as a woman. And so I think that's when we really started to see the shifts in the third, fourth, fifth chapters.
Yes. Like you were saying before, she does this in the book through taking us through art, especially at the beginning, it's through art. Mm-hmm. And then as we move through, there's magazines and newspapers and periodicals. And my favorite discussion is the discussion around magazines for me personally, because that has a personal component for me. And then she kind of goes into medical journals and medicine and how that all happens. I love how she takes us through these things as though, like, I could see her almost, if, you know, 100 years from now, she was looking at our era, looking at it and going, okay, and then in social media, what happened? Because I feel like that's kind of an extension of what she's looking at. And I love how she takes us through all these different things to make us aware of what is happening culturally.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think, you know, and I know we're going to talk a little bit about this. I was in this book club that went through each chapter of the book every week. And we definitely saw the parallels of social media and social media apps in perpetuating a lot of the messages, especially in the first four chapters of the book that talk about, you know, kind of this male gaze determining what beauty is. And then in the second chapter, right, they go more into like what makes a beautiful woman, right? What makes a beautiful Black woman? What makes a beautiful woman of color? And they get very specific. And it's like, I remember one of the observations I made, it seems like these men, it was almost like cannibalistic, like very centered around consumption, where if they could, they would literally chop up body parts of all these different women and put them together for their perfect woman. And that's what they spent hours in their parlors talking about, right? And there was just something so dehumanizing about that and how it's perpetuated in social media today.
Yes. And I, you know, when you say that, the rest of the book does seem to focus on what men think about women, except if we take out the discussions around magazines, because most of those magazine editors were women. But the majority of figures that we do see in this book are men, and their discussions around beauty and what it means to be beautiful and why being thin matters. And I think it just reeks of patriarchy the whole way through.
Yeah, I feel like it does. But at the same time, I feel like there are so many white women in the book that reinforce that.
Oh, God. Yes.
Like, I think one of the things, right, that we have to keep in mind when we look at the historical record is that who was given a voice during these times? And the majority was white men. But when you especially go through later chapters, right, looking at the 19th century Anglo-Protestantism and the movement of these men that were, in essence, right, like prophets around wellness and then like health, who were the biggest number, like who was supporting them? Overwhelmingly white women by far. So I think it's like it was dictated by men, but you see the complicity, right? Is that the word? Of white women in, you know, like what you're saying is 100% right. Yeah. And it only gets worse throughout time.
Yes. That is such an important point. like I said at the beginning, I feel like this book is an explanation as to how we got here, and it couldn't have been done without, as much as the voices of individual white women maybe didn't matter, but the numbers mm-hmm. did.
Exactly.
And that, I think, is a really, really important point.
I love that. I love the way you said that. Yeah. Like, the individual white women didn't matter, but the numbers in which they supported yes. harmful white men did. Mm. I'm gonna keep that.
So we talk a little bit about art and how all that happens in there. And then, you know, we kind of move into this whole magazine culture and the Gibson girl. Actually, you know what I want to talk about first?
Mm-hmm.
Sarah Bartman.
Oh, yes. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Because the first time I read the book, I recognized that she was a relevant figure and important in this discussion, but I don't think I quite recognized how relevant she was to this discussion about what perpetuating this idea about the fear of Black bodies. And so I think, if you wouldn't mind, could you discuss a little bit about who she is and her yes. relevance?
I can briefly, but I think this is a great point to interject kind of what we were talking as we set up for this interview, right? Mm-hmm. So the place I think where me and you are approaching this book today, right, is very much more of an academic perspective. I have, with my background in like cultural anthropology, public health, nutrition, health equity, right? This is a subject matter that is very interesting to me. And I am fat, right? So especially in the later chapters of the book, when they talk about the obesity epidemic and everything, I can relate to a lot. But I think because of especially the title of the book and, you know, just what you mentioned, right, is that you didn't realize the role that Sarah Bartman had in kind of the proliferation of what a Black woman body should look like, I think indicates, right, the level of distance we have from this issue. And so, for example, I was in a book club on the Clubhouse app, and I was the only non-Black person, and there were Black women of size that were leading the discussion. I was just supporting in any way I could. And they all knew about Sarah Bartman. They were very familiar with her, because their lived experiences are informed by the tropes and by the experiences Sarah Bartman had during that time. So just very briefly, Sarah Bartman was a Black woman that was basically utilized in Western Europe. This is even like kind of painful to talk about because it was just so horrible. I think I'm going to keep it short just because I could see that it could be very traumatizing to people. She was a woman that was brought to Western Europe under the mastership, I'll say it, of a white man and a Black man. And she was paraded around as a spectacle in different areas of Western Europe. Just the whole story is incredibly, it's disgusting. I really don't know another way to say that. But I think her story is incredibly relevant to the topic of the book because it just shows very early on the dehumanization of Black women when under the white gaze, right? And I think definitely there are Black women that are much better positioned to talk about the impact and story of that mm-hmm. than I am. So I think I'm just mm-hmm. going to leave it at that.
Okay. I think for me when reading, she became where these connections that are stereotyped and that racial science, I'm going to put this in quotations, racial science picks up on, that is where they start to gain steam and momentum is around her as a figure.
Yeah.
And that was the piece I missed the first time I read through. And I think that because I feel like when we get to the end of the book and we're trying to look at where we are now, these connections, she ends the book with a statement saying, "The image of fat Black women as savage and barbarous in art, philosophy, and science, as diseased in medicine, has been used to both degrade Black women and discipline white women." And I think the first time I read through, I was like, okay, well, where exactly did some of those stereotypes come from? Like, I understand that when we talk about race science, and I'm sure we'll get there, and mm-hmm. Protestantism, these were big things about what it means to be white. but mm-hmm. there wasn't as many talking about what it meant to be Black, because for them it was sort of like, well, duh, you know? And so I think for me, Sarah became a pivotal figure that when I reread it through, I was like, she's important in this discussion around how we get from here to there. And you're right. Her experiences are horrifying, just horrifying. Yeah. So,
and unfortunately to say they're not unique. You know, I think one of the parts that connected me to this book is the extent in which they talk about how the field of anthropology is responsible for the proliferation of things like race science and eugenics. And it's I have such a conflicted relationship with this degree that I got, because it was on one hand, it allowed me to look for different ways to observe the world and to make sense of the world. But at the same time, the field of anthropology, because it was started by white men, the goal of anthropologists during the height of imperialism was to basically make imperialism and colonization as successful as possible. Because, you know, they said that if they understood the savages and the people that were in these different countries, they would be able to dominate them. They would be able to overtake them. And so, you know, the folks that I think, because after Sarah Barton died, right, her body was, this is so hard to talk about. They basically desecrated her body.
Yeah.
And that was done by anthropologists and by physicians. And so, you know, I think it's important to really take a critical lens to the role that anthropology, because, you know, Sabrina Strings is a sociologist, which in many ways is a cultural anthropologist.
Right.
So it's just so interesting because she used, you know, sociology and anthropological frameworks to tell this story. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, these frameworks have been responsible for the dehumanization and destruction of so many people and cultures across history.
Wow. So have you seen any shifts within I mean, obviously there's that kind of rhetoric isn't being perpetuated anymore, but that doesn't mean those same ideas are not still there. Like, have you seen a shift?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I didn't learn a lot about, like, even when I was in my undergrad program, I learned some, right? I think one of the classes I took that was the most illuminating around the role that anthropology played in a lot of the harm we do to each other was around the Iraqi war, but I didn't learn about the racist roots of anthropology. I didn't know how Hitler was a huge anthropology fanatic and really looked up to American anthropologists as a way to craft his final plan, right? And so I didn't learn about that until way after. And this was about 10 years ago, a little bit more. Mm-hmm. But I think that, you know, this framework is useful because obviously there are more people that come from these colonized places that have been colonized, that have experienced historical marginalization that can use the same approach, but to tell a different story. And so, you know, I can say there's a shift because Sabrina Strings, even though if you listen to some of her many of her interviews, she talks about the pushback she got in trying to publish this research and how nobody would support her in this. So she was able to do it, but not with the majority of the support with people in her field. So I don't know what that tells you.
Well, it tells me that that I'm really grateful for her persistence because I think that there's so much value in this. I want to get in. There's two other things that I really want to talk about with you, and they're both big things. So I want to talk about this idea of beauty and beauty ideals and how it shifted and changed over time. And I also want to talk about how medicine, because she ends with discussion of medicine, which I want to talk about as being such an interesting thing to end on. So if we can start with just kind of going into beauty and how... I mean, I guess it's the second part of that quote that I read from Sabrina Strings about how these beauty ideals were being used to discipline white women, really. Oh,
absolutely. 100%. Yeah. You saw that through the good portion of like that middle part, chapters 4, 5, and 6, of how, you know, and I think I've written a little bit about this when we talk about American white exceptionalism, right? About how part of that is to indoctrinate white women to believe that they are the ones that are responsible for carrying the race forward. Therefore, they have to be what is deemed the most valuable or accepted in order to move the race forward, right? Like it's really talked, I can't remember if it was chapter 6, chapter 5, where they really start to talk about eugenics and what that has to do with the white exceptionalism movement, basically saying that it was the responsibility of the white woman to be in the most optimal form, because if she were to bear children, it was under her supervision that they would thrive to be the purest, the most valuable Anglo-Saxon class, high class group of people, right? So from very beginning, right, the onus was put on the white woman to be responsible for this. And so it wasn't just about bearing children. It wasn't just about raising children, but it was about being a walking example of what the highest form of human being was, which to them was a thin Anglo-Saxon woman. And so, you know, I think we see that especially in the 19th century, and how it kind of shifts to today, right? Like it's not as overt, right? Like we're not telling white women anymore, hey, you need to get your body right because you need to bear 6 children that look just like you so we can make sure that the white race continues. It's done a lot more subtly, but the same tactics are used. So I just think over the generations, it's just been a level of conditioning that we have associated being as close as proximity to whiteness in general, because you see this also with the mass immigration movements, right, of the late 19th century, early 20th century, where, you know, white women were even more hell-bent on being as close to the ideal of whiteness, which was the Anglo-Saxon, right, the Anglo-Saxon white woman, and using their thinness as a way to differentiate themselves from the Southern Europeans, mm-hmm. from the Celts, and from the Eastern Europeans. So as these three groups, right, move closer to this ideal of whiteness, you see them mimicking a lot of the same practices, tactics, mm-hmm. beliefs, mm-hmm. To kind of assert themselves in that dominant category.
And so as immigration patterns shift, because now immigration patterns have definitely shifted, mm-hmm. you know, we're...
Oh, I see the same things.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I am part of the Latinx diaspora, mm-hmm. right? We are very impacted by colonization, colorism, white supremacy. And I think the way that our own beauty ideals, right? The way that we perceive ourselves, we have definitely... There are so many parallels to what I read in the book, to how we were perceived, what I call quote unquote before, right? And how we're perceived now, right? Where we see it as a general more acceptance, but part of that, right, is because we have been indoctrinated into this concept of whiteness, mm-hmm. right? With the intent to reject anything that has to do with Blackness. So we see that in so many different ways, absolutely.
Well, and you know, I mean, I think for me getting into body liberation, originally it was just a personal thing, my own relationship with food. And then I read The Body Is Not an Apology, mm-hmm. and she starts talking about how the body is political.
Absolutely.
And it was mind blowing to me. Mm-hmm. It was like, it's political? Wait, what? All of a sudden, everything I was watching on the news shifted for me. And it was definitely eye opening. And yeah, I think I get some of this in this book too, where it's like all of a sudden these things that are happening in the world around us, the culture that we're living in, the messages that we're getting from the culture are just reflecting back cultural beliefs that are not really in any kind of rooted in any kind of science. Like, I think this is the thing that absolutely. Really pissed me off as I read was like, racial science isn't real. Like what they're talking mm-hmm. about in these discussions, nobody has any basis for fact in anything that they're doing. And right. it's just so absolutely infuriating.
Yeah, but even if it isn't real, right? Like we can all agree that it's not real. The foundation is completely made up and it was, you know, used to push a very specific agenda, but yet this fake, this not real bullshit science informs the lived experiences of so many people in this world, right? Of so many, this desire, basically a collective attitude of anti-Blackness, right, can be rooted in complete BS, but it is very real to the people experiencing it and has very real impact.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Yes.
And speaking of that, I think, you know, experiences, I think that this is the perfect segue to talk about medicine because as she talks about in the book, there was a real shift from Protestantism being what was teaching us our quote unquote values, to medicine being what is actually telling us how to live. And she uses that phrase, how to live. How does medicine now start to factor in? The thing that I think is hilarious with this book, well, not hilarious, but the thing that ironic, I guess, to me was that we spend from like the 1600s well up until like the mid 1800s before we even talk about medicine, even having any kind of an idea that thinness or being in a larger body or Blackness, that it even really matters.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and it's not till 1920 when we actually start getting some discussion around it. So I know you have thoughts, so I'll let you go.
Yeah. I feel like this part is my bread and butter because of my, because, you know, I work in public health. My background in anthropology was really around food and health, right? And how health is informed by a lot of our cultural beliefs, not only on an individual level, but on a systemic level. So I just, like I said, starting chapter 7 with this book, like the way that the invention of breakfast cereals ties into everything we believe around diets and food today, I think is one of the most fascinating stories in US history. Like if you don't know about it, if you don't know the story of Kellogg and Post and graham crackers, like it is probably one of the most valuable gems I think I've ever come across, especially like in my, like, I think in my body liberation journey, because it just shows like the quackery, like it is just, I'll use it again. It is just so bananas how, you know, these sets of beliefs were integrated into modern medical and scientific practices. So anyway, so yes, you're right. I know that Sabrina Strings has a quote in the book. I'm not sure where, but that the disdain of fatness and the, you know, basically disgust around quote unquote obesity predates the medical establishment's any kind of statement on it by 100 years or more. So the role that Anglo-Protestantism plays in our perception of what health is and what, like you said, the best way to live our life really stems from religion. Like it stems from religion. And, you know, in the beginning, right, in the 19th century, when, you know, health and fitness and all that were becoming a craze and a trend, right, it was driven by like religious zealots, by this ideology that by aspiring to perfect health, by aspiring to thinness, right, which is a reflection of health, you would be closer to godliness, right? You hear that message woven into so much of our religious our religious rhetoric today. But how that specifically, especially up in Michigan, right, in like in the Midwest, how that fueled this movement where your aspiration to be healthy was equal to alignment with the spiritual, and how this belief, right, spurred the sanitariums, right, spurred, you know, the discourse that this food is good for you and this food is not bad for you, and let me create all these foods in a way like as told to me by a higher power of what you should be eating, right? So that's the basis of like breakfast cereals. And as more and more people become obsessed, right, with wanting to use their diet as a way to achieve moral purity and the parallels that has with racial purity, that's where you see the interest in people wanting to know what their weight is. Like, people had no interest in wanting to know what their weight is before the late 19th century. And like, scales weren't even in doctor's office first. They were in drugstores. They were in retail stores. Like, I don't know if they have them anymore, but like those machines that you see where you put the quarter in and then like, and like you can get your weight. I used to see them growing up, like in restaurants. I used to see them on the boardwalk, right? Like on beaches. You would see them in like your CVS in the old days, right? Walgreens. It was a game, right? People just thought it was fun to know what your weight was. And that was how it started. And it wasn't until 30 or 40 years later where people got the idea to put them into doctor's offices. And just think of how all these little things spur the medical industrial complex that we have now.
Yeah.
And how this focus on weight really is not a, it's only been around for about 100 years, maybe 120 at this point.
Yeah.
So yeah, so I just found the last two chapters incredibly important because it really highlighted the way that weight and but specifically weight, not even body size at this point. It was specifically weight became such an important metric for health insurance companies and how that translated into the healthcare setting we have now and how it still is, right? It does a really good job talking about the evolution of like using weight and height as a metric, right? We all know the story of like BMI, that it's BS, of course, but you know, the outlining it just from the beginning where there was this one provider that he wasn't even really a doctor. He was like a health guru that thought that if you ate, and I can't remember this specifically, like this might be somebody else, but if you had an all dairy diet, right? Like you would be healthy. You would, you know, avoid sickness. Into, you know, other doctors of that time using diet and weight as a way to control women, right? Because of this concept of like, of the white woman being the kind of ideal carrier of the white race, right? Making sure that white women were healthy. So by weighing them, right, you would make sure they weren't too underweight because that was a risk factor, right? Like in not having a healthy pregnancy. But then it started to flip. So just, you know, going from the way that media portrayed bodies, right, in the magazines and everything like that, to, you know, how thinness became a vanity issue, to how it connected and became a health issue because it was tied to white women having babies, and then how it became racialized later on and how it's being used today to racialize.
Yes. Yes. The fact that there was no studies done and then all of a sudden that starts to change. It was just like, because she talked about how the race scientists sort of thought, well, the black race is going to peter out.
Yeah.
So we do not need to pay attention.
Right. So you don't need to invest in basically any non-white communities because of what they believed, which was Darwin's, you know, survival of the fittest, where Darwin was an anthropologist too, by the way, super, super racist. They thought by the survival of the fittest, you didn't have to worry about non-white communities because they would kill themselves off or they would die out.
What do you think it says about the culture that we're living in today that now all of a sudden we're placing so much emphasis onto especially the black female body in the medical community?
I think in my work, doing policy work, doing advocacy work around just health disparities in general, I think it's disingenuous that I'm just going to say it, because as we learn more about what contributes to positive health outcomes, the data, right? If we rely on data, the data says that individual personal behaviors don't play as big of a part as our environment, as maybe a little bit our genetics, but our access to care, the way we're treated, right? Like that has a bigger impact. And so the science, I think that the data might not lie on that, but do we see an effort in restructuring or completely demolishing the environment and building an environment that supports the health of like communities of color. No, they would rather say, oh no, it's not about the environment. It's not about racism. It's because they don't eat right. They, quote unquote, they don't exercise. They don't take care of themselves. So, you know, public opinion has changed in the sense where it's like more and more of the US at least, right? We are more racially diverse, I think, than we have been in a long time. And so I think this goes back, right, to that binary that I was talking in the beginning, right? We have a structure set in place that values whiteness and wants to reject anything that has to do with blackness. So how does the group that values whiteness and wants to control society using these concepts of like of whiteness, how do we align as many people with that concept as possible, while at the same time not giving them any systemic power for them to actually make change and to get rid of this binary altogether? So I feel what I've observed doing this work, I've been in the food and nutrition stuff for 15 years, but I've been in the public health sphere for maybe 9 or 10. I see this dynamic a lot, and I see this dynamic in other people of color. Like the way that we've been taught to believe that our individual behaviors are responsible for our health outcomes in this country, within my own like community, I think just asserts how much we are willing to align ourselves with whiteness rather than really look at the systemic structures, the other, what I call social determinants of health, that are actually killing bodies of color. And the way that the obesity epidemic has been, I don't know if the word's managed, has been, you know, propagandized, has been capitalized on, has been perpetuated, like just the messaging, right? It hurts communities of color the most in this country. So I think, you know, this whole kind of underlying white supremacist narrative that like, oh, well, we don't have to worry about them because they're gonna like die out anyway. It's still happening in a way because they don't want to invest in any of the actual structures that contribute to positive health.
Mm. Yes.
Like they want to have like soda taxes or like restrict what we can buy on SNAP, yeah. Right? They want to have junk food taxes,
yes.
Whatever all that means, but they don't want to actually invest in things that actually have a bigger impact, yes, on health.
Yes. If they truly cared about health for people of color, they would be looking at these things and actually, mm-hmm, making some changes, and they're not. Yes. Yes. Infuriating.
Yeah.
I have loved this so much, like so much. So I guess I've got two more questions. First off, is there anything, mm-hmm, else you want to say about the book before I move into my last question?
Yes. I just wanted to take a note. So I have been able to read this book several times because I'm very familiar with the way that it's structured and everything. I have heard from people, this is a little bit of a challenging book to get through, mm-hmm, because it is written from such an academic lens. I want to, you know, offer that, you know, this doesn't have to be a book that you read all the way through in one sitting, right? Take your time with it. This is definitely, treat it more like a textbook than a novel. And so, you know, I don't want to deter people from reading it though, because it's such an important piece of text that really connects the dots in so many ways. So I want to offer that.
Yes. Yes, it did for me. This was integral, you know, to my understanding of, well, and I mean, I have a shit ton of privilege. I mean, I am a white cisgendered female. I have a shit ton of privilege. Mm-hmm. I don't sometimes get it, you know, and this book helped me connect a lot of dots that I can never understand the experiences, but at least on, as we were talking before, an academic level, I can begin to understand some of the components that make up the situation that we're currently in. So I'm super grateful for it. It's a great read, but I totally agree with you too. It's definitely not a, I'm going to sit down on a Sunday afternoon and read a good book.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. You definitely have to digest it little by little and treat it as you would a textbook.
Totally. Okay. My last question that I ask all my guests is, let's say a friend of yours has read this book, really enjoyed it, and would like another read that's kind of in a similar vein or that definitely has body liberation concepts in it. What would you recommend?
So I believe they're tied to body liberation because body liberation really allows us to pursue collective liberation, right? And I have a quote that I keep by me all the time that basically says, you know, I am not free while any woman is unfree, even when her shackles are very different than her own. So in the spirit of believing that in order for us to really achieve our own body liberation, we must focus and center the bodies that are most marginalized in order to be liberated. So there are two books I actually have. So one I thought of after our kind of discussion about the complicity of white women in a lot of the themes in this book. And there's this book that's called They Were Her Property, White Women as Slave Owners in the American South. And it does a really great job kind of outlining, and it does touch on a lot of the themes that we kind of talk about, right? Where white women as individuals, right? They might not have power, but in strong numbers, the way that they support the patriarchy and white supremacy, they're incredibly powerful. So it examines that. There is another book that I use. It's also a little bit like a textbook. This one is called The Body of the Conquistador, Food, Race, and the Colonial Experience in Spanish America, 1492 through 1700. And I use this book a lot, and it's by Rebecca Earle. And I use this book a lot in my education because as we talk about hierarchies, right, as we talk about social hierarchies, we talk about the hierarchies of body. But because of my work, I do a lot of work in the food justice space. Concepts like food moralizing, the concept of healthy food, right, is very much tied to, it's tied to racism and it's tied also to colonization. So this book does a really good job kind of looking at Spanish colonization into the Americas and the role that food, class, and race play into our perceptions around food as well.
Oh. Those both sound like intense, important reads.
Yeah, they are. Sorry. I'm an intense reader.
I love it. I always put links to these books in the show notes below. So if anybody's listening and is interested, there will definitely be a link to them below. Patchouli, can I ask you to tell our listeners where they can find you and what kind of things you've got going on right now that you'd like to promote?
Absolutely. So I work on an institutional level, so I don't do kind of one-on-one coaching or anything like that. So I really work on the institutional level. I work with universities. I work with nonprofit organizations. I work with healthcare providers on, you know, applying a body liberation framework to their respective organizations. So you can find me. I have a website and that's embodylib.com, embodylib.com. And I'm known as the Body Lib Advocate on Instagram. That's where I'm kind of most active. So that's at @the_BodyLib, BODYLIB _advocate. And you can find me there, but on my website, you can get connected to my Facebook and my Twitter and all that good stuff. And, you know, because my name is so unique, if you look for me, you'll find me.
Awesome. Well, I'll have links to all of your stuff below. So people can just scroll down and click. No problem. I just want to thank you again for this really, really delightful conversation. Thank you so much for coming on Fat Girl Book Club, Patchouli.
Yay, I'm so excited. Thank you for having me.
That book is so powerful. And like I was saying in this conversation, every time I listen to it, I get something else out of it. And every time I talk to somebody, I get something else out of it. And the one thing I'm definitely going to be taking away from this conversation with Patchouli is her pointing out that while, yes, this book is covered in male figures, and it really is, there's a lot of different male figures that pushed a lot of these concepts forward. the people who were supporting those males and supporting those ideas the most were women. Mainly white Anglo-Saxon Protestant women. So, yeah, it took a man to put the idea forward, but it takes women to actually push that idea to its fullest extent. We would not be here if it wasn't for women perpetuating these ideas. That gave me some food for thought. Because when I was reading it, the way my brain was working was going, okay, well, all these men thinking that they can tell women what, you know, what beauty's supposed to look like and, you know, pushing all this race science and, you know, being the money behind all of these magazines that were pushing these ideas forward. These ideas would not got off the ground if women haven't said, yeah, I fully and wholeheartedly support them. I can't let women off the hook anymore the way that I maybe did when I first read this book. So that will definitely be something that I will be thinking about as I go and read this book again, because I'm sure this book isn't going away and there is definitely the possibility of bringing it back on again for a third round on Fat Girl Book Club. Again, if this is your first time with us, welcome, and please check out that free resource for you. Show notes will have the link. Keep reading, everyone.